doing a lot. I don't know how you manage since this is their first time doing our show. So, callers, you gave her a good workout. So, thank you all. And stay tuned to more programming here on your community radio program, KBOO.FM. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I will speak with you next time.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for construction apprentices registered with the state of Oregon in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the show this morning. Today, we're going to talk about civil rights and the law in the context of authoritarian rule. Does our legal system protect us, or can it be deployed against us? And what is our best defense? Before we take up those critical questions, I want to ask you if this is a discussion you would ever hear on the commercial airwaves. Of course it isn't, but it's a necessary conversation, and we bring it to you on your listener-supported and volunteer-run radio station, KBOO. If you can, please support community radio in Portland by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, 97214. The KBOO community thanks you. We'll begin our show today with Fran Michel speaking with Professor Emeritus of American Studies at Purdue, Bill Mullen, about tenured Professor Tom Alter at Texas State University, who was summarily fired for his off-campus remarks as a private citizen in favor of socialism. His firing is a flagrant violation of academic freedom and freedom of speech. Bill Mullen, chairperson of the committee to defend Tom Alter, talks with Fran about what's unique and important about this case, the international outpouring of support for Alter and the significance of his legal avenues of defense. Following that, yours truly, as our well-read Red, will read excerpts from an article by public interest lawyer and professor at City University of New York, Chamtoli Huck. She takes a close look at Trump's executive order that brands Antifa as a terrorist organization, arguing that legal challenges to this and other infringements on our civil rights are necessary, but slow and unpredictable. If they are won, it's often long after the damage has been done. Grassroots organizing to defend communities under attack, on the other hand, creates solidarity and security and affirms the right to dissent. We'll close our show with an international angle on questions of the courts, the law, and defense of peoples under attack. In their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker review the UN's role in halting Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinians. They talk about the successes and failures of various UN institutions and how the legal and political landscape is changing due to widespread and growing international condemnation of Israel. Now, let's turn to Fran Michel and Bill Mullen on fired professor Tom Alter.
Good morning. I'm Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour, here with Bill Mullen, emeritus professor of American Studies at Purdue University and author of many articles and books, including The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition, co-authored with Janelle Hope, and We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law. He's also chair of the Committee to Defend Tom Alter, a coalition of faculty, students, staff, union members, and community supporters dedicated to protecting academic freedom and free speech rights. Thank you for joining us on The Old Mole.
Thanks, Fran. Glad to be here.
So Tom Alter is a history professor who was abruptly fired from his tenured position at Texas State University over remarks he made at a socialist conference in his capacity as a private citizen. But he's not the first faculty member fired in recent years for political reasons. He wasn't even the first Texas State faculty member fired that same week. A senior lecturer, Melissa McCool, was fired over discussing gender in an English class. Last year, Maura Finkelstein was fired from a tenured position because of her support for Palestine on social media. And many other faculty have lost their jobs after being targeted, often by Turning Point USA for teaching about race or gender, or in the wake of its founder's death for quoting his statements or criticizing his legacy. So I'd like us to talk about both what's distinctive about Tom Alter's case and also about how it might be part of a larger pattern of attacks on universities and university faculty. So what else do we need to know about how this case has unfolded so far?
Sure. The thing that's distinctive about Tom's case, I think, is that he was speaking as a socialist. And most of the people that have been fired in recent days and years have been fired for other things. Speaking up for Palestine, talking about gender, speaking out about the Charlie Kirk killing. But Tom was simply saying, I'm a socialist, I believe in socialism, and they fired him. And it kind of reminds us, this is what we call the new McCarthyism, or what we call in the Committee to Defend Tom Alter, MAGA McCarthyism, because it reminds us that the Trump administration and this regime is really committed to rolling back history in every way, like taking us back to the Cold War, taking us back to the Red Scare, taking us back to things like the Smith Act, you know, which was used to fire Trotskyists and communists in the 1940s. And that's what Tom's case signifies in many ways. It's a piece of history coming back to haunt us in America, but kind of repackaged now under the larger umbrella of repression, as you describe it, right? And what I mean by MAGA McCarthyism is that the tent for repression is really, really wide right now, because this is a state whose authoritarian leanings depends upon really destroying civil society as we know it, eroding civil rights and democratic rights of all kinds, rights to vote, the legitimacy of elections, women's rights to have an abortion, the right to be a citizen of the United States, you know, Trump's attack on the 14th Amendment, so-called birthright citizenship takes us all the way back to, you know, the post-Reconstruction era, when that 14th Amendment was designated to give Black people the right to live in this country. And so it's a capacious, ambitious, what I call aspirational fascist project. And I use that term advisedly, but what I mean by that is that this wholesale federal attack on working people, on queer people, on trans people, on migrants, on immigrants, etc., has all the hallmarks of an authoritarian slash fascist state. So Tom's case signifies one piece of that. And, you know, socialists always remember that, you know, it was communists and socialists who were the first to be kind of thrown under the bus in Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, because they were the first people to stand up and fight against fascism. And Tom Alter is an anti-fascist. I mean, there's no question he is. And so for us, all of these things are signified by Tom's case, and they're all reasons why fighting for Tom Alter is fighting for so many people. And when we defend Tom, it really is in the name of free speech, not just for him, but for all these people that we feel deserve protection and deserve democracy.
Well, you've anticipated some of my follow-up questions. I was going to mention Tom Alter has referred in interviews to the parallel of fascist attacks in the 1920s in Italy on universities, starting with universities, going to unions. So he was also framing this as part of something that looks like fascism. And you are a scholar of fascism and fascist formations in America and the way that law is complicit with that. And part of the campaign around this has been asking people to contact the Texas Board of Regents, which is where his case is going next. Mm-hmm. Is there any hope in pushing back against this case, given that the Board of Regents in Texas is appointed by the governor, who has sworn to eliminate leftists from the universities and leftism and wokeism and whatever he's calling it lately? What do you see as the role of that kind of systemic and legal checks? I mean, because one of the things about Alter's case is the violation of due process. That there was supposed to be a process before any faculty member, particularly a faculty member with tenure, is fired. That was not adhered to. He has a legal case partly based on that failure. Mm-hmm. How does using the law as a way to respond to these cases, what do you see as the role of law in maybe resisting fascism, as well as the ways that, as you've written about, laws in the U.S. can be complicit with or create the conditions for fascism?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, we're fighting for Tom's legal right to keep his job. And we have to do that because that's the terrain on which we fight. That is to say, Tom's lawsuit against the university depends upon showing that Texas State University violated its own internal processes. He was obligated, for example, to have a hearing before he was fired, and he was not. The Texas state law requires that employees of universities who are fired are due a hearing as well. So due process is important because it's a piece of democracy that we can't let go of under the current conditions that we live under. We can criticize the law for failing sometimes to do what we want it to do, but we actually have to use it to our advantage when it means the survival of our families and keeping our jobs. So that's one part of it. It's a very pragmatic campaign to use the courts to defend him. And in fact, he's getting legal representation from his union, which is the American Federation of Teachers. Tom's a member of the American Association of University Professors. And we realize as union members that union rights are really under attack. And one way in which we can try to fight to preserve those rights is in the courts as well. So that's one part of our campaign. At a broader level, we don't know what the outcome of the case is going to be. I mean, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, has said in firing other people in the Texas state system, we are at war ideologically with people who disagree with us, who are pro-woke. That's a pretty explicit statement of what we're up against, right? Now, to go back to our earlier discussion, we are trying to preserve and widen the scope of democracy. We are trying to maintain a space for civil liberties. We're trying to resist creeping fascism. We're trying to say that Tom represents all of us who are pushing back against this avalanche of authoritarian repression. So in the broadest sense, our fight against Greg Abbott is a fight against that. And then the last thing I would say about the law here is, you know, anybody who's listening to your show knows that the Trump administration, like other authoritarian states in history, has tried to manipulate the law to advance authoritarianism itself, right? People often say, well, the rule of law will save us from fascism. Actually, every fascist regime uses the courts to its advantage. The Italian courts did this, the German courts did this, the American courts under Trump are doing this. So we can't be complacent about whether the law is always going to help us. In fact, you know, one of the things that we argue is that no one's going to save us but ourselves in a case like this. We have to be ruthless and vigilant in using the tools at our disposal, including legal tools, but also recognizing that the apparatus of the state and the courts is very often stacked against the weak and the vulnerable and the powerless. And in this instance right now, Tom is in that latter group, but we feel, and I guess this is the last point I would make, one reason that Tom has decided to fight this out publicly is that we think that fighting publicly is winning. And what I mean by that is you have to claim public space. Just like we have to march on the streets, like at the No Kings protest, we have to protest loudly and vocally when something unjust has happened. There would be no civil rights movement without this. There would be no justice. So that's part of it too, is to try to seize part of the public domain to say this is wrong and we are right. And that's really what is the basis of the committee to defend Tom Alter.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I was wondering about in terms of this question of, you know, what's distinctive about Tom Alter's case is, as we've said, there's a huge wave of attacks on universities, on university presidents, on free speech of various sorts, on civil rights and voting rights. And so it struck me as interesting that this particular case has gotten such quick traction, that there's a committee in his defense. I mean, why Tom Alter rather than any of the other cases that have happened recently? And it seems like part of that has to do with the strength of his position in terms mm-hmm. of that legal structure, because he is tenured. So that puts him in a stronger position than many of the other faculty who've been ousted or pushed out because of their free speech. He's also, as you say, he's willing to come out publicly about it. It's my understanding that, for instance, Maura Finkelstein did not go public with what was happening to her until the process had already been gone through at the university level. So some of it is his willingness to speak out. And I wonder if some of it has to do with, as you say, his position as a socialist, as a union mm-hmm. member, as a very popular teacher, that so quickly so many people have rallied around his cause, partly because there were pre-existing structures of organization and potential support already in place that could be drawn on. Can you say anything about sort of why this case and how the committee in his support has come together?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, one thing I would say, you know, is everybody who's being oppressed or victimized by a powerful system has to make difficult decisions about how to fight and where to fight. And, you know, I think we in the committee have great sympathy. We know that, for example, there's other people at Texas State University who've been victimized by the same administration and have chosen different routes to go. You know, there's an old saying in the labor movement and in the socialist movement, which is an injury to one is an injury to all. And I think that really is the ethos behind Tom's public campaign. He knows that he's fighting for his own job. He knows he's fighting for his own family. But he also knows that he's fighting for much broader principles, that if the Texas State University and the state of Texas can do this to him and fire him without due process, it can do this to anyone, any worker, you know, an insurance salesman, a domestic worker, a fast food worker who decides to come to work and express a political point of view can be made vulnerable. As socialists, you know, we fight as a class, right? We fight for horizontally for people in the working class. And I think that's really the approach that Tom is taking, that we all know that university professors have some privilege and some status, and of course they make decent amounts of money, but they are still wage laborers under a capitalist system that has an enormous amount of power to do us harm. And so fighting back against it is part of what we do. But it's, again, I just want to stress, if you ever listen to Tom talk about his own case, he really says, look, I draw my strength from you. I fight for you because you fight for me. He always talks about love and solidarity in the movement. And it's really real, because the minute Tom was fired, he's got loads of students who adore him at his campus, right? And he's been a faculty advisor to student organizations, Students for Justice in Palestine. He's a really beloved figure. And the day after he was publicly fired, there was a spontaneous demonstration on the campus of students. Tom had nothing to do with that. So the popular will is on our side. It's kind of like fighting Trump, you know? His approval rating is 37%. That means 63% of people think he's terrible. On the ground in San Marcos, Texas, this is very much the dynamic. Tom tells me when he went to a Texas State football game recently, and he went up to the concession stand, you know, like at halftime, and the student worker there gave him free like French fries. He said, "Oh, you're Tom Alter. We're on your side, right?" So ordinary people get it, because they know if they go to work and their boss fires them without due process, that's bad for them too. So it really is, in a weird way, a labor of love to fight for somebody like Tom, and for Tom to make this fight. And it just reminds us that it's possible to use your voice, your public platform, to kind of be like an echo of what people want, which is many people want more freedom and more liberty and more right to speak, especially in the moment we're living in. And you know, we're experiencing it every day. I mean, this fight is about the same kinds of issues that people in your city are experiencing. And again, I would just say the committee came together because it was full of people who felt that way. It wasn't that we were all Tom's friends, although he is my friend. People have come from all over the country. I will say it's been incredibly exciting. We've had people in Brazil translate our campaign material into Portuguese. We've had people in France translate our appeals for Tom into French. He's been interviewed by newspapers in England. He's actually speaking to an English trade labor union next week. Tom's firing is an international phenomenon because, one, people are paying close attention to Trumpism because they recognize the United States as what Martin Luther King called the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And two, because, again, people all over the world work for a living, and when they see a coworker fired unjustly, it resonates for them. So the support and the network of people in the committee to defend Tom Alter is actually, you know, quite broad and quite exciting.
You mentioned that he is tenured professors are in a position of relative privilege, even as workers. And it might be worth clarifying for listeners who aren't familiar with the idea of academic tenure, that what it means, right, is essentially the right to due process before dismissal, which, as you say, is the sort of thing everybody should have, right, rather than being able to be dismissed for, right, no reason, right, at will employment.
Right. Absolutely. You know, one of the foundations for tenure in the United States is a policy that was articulated by the American Association of University Professors in 1940, which was a definition of academic freedom. And it really simply stated that academics, professors have the right to research and write about and teach about whatever they wish, and that they shouldn't be terminated or lose their jobs on the basis of their intellectual pursuits, whatever those might be, right? I mean, Tom has simply been fired because he's a socialist. So his academic freedom to speak as a socialist has been egregiously violated. It's been violated a second time because he wasn't even at work. He was acting as a private citizen. And in the AUP, the American Association University Professors' definition of academic freedom, it extends to what is called extramural speech. Extramural speech means the right to speak as a private citizen, to speak outside of the confines of work. So Tom's rights have been violated in a kind of double sense here, his academic freedom, his right to extramural speech. So it really smashes a longstanding paradigm that's been used to protect academics in the United States. Tenure, as you point out, is especially sacred because you have to work for 7 years just to get it. You have to prove yourself as a scholar. Tom actually has published a very, very important and well-received book on Southern labor history, published by the University of Illinois Press, which earned him tenure at Texas State University. And that's why the academic freedom part is so important. Tom's book is actually a little bit about the socialist movement in Texas, right? Ironically, but one has to be protected to do that work as long as it is good work and it is valuable work and it is esteemed by your colleagues. Tom cleared all of those bars. So he's simply been fired explicitly for political reasons, and his right to free speech has been egregiously violated.
And it seems like it's also a case that really highlights the binary opposition between socialism and fascism, given yes. that he was speaking at a socialist conference as a socialist. That's the grounds for his being fired. And the social media person who surreptitiously recorded his talk and edited it and posted it and called for his dismissal is an avowed fascist. So it yes. seems like the socialist versus fascist opposition is becoming more clearly visible, heightened.
Yeah, you know, it's a wonderful historical point. The woman who doxed Tom is a self-avowed fascist and an anti-Semite. And the fact that her doctored video of Tom's speech was accepted prima facie by the Texas State University president and the governor's office, as it were, is a really scary reminder that socialism is oftentimes seen as anathema to fascists because it represents everything that fascism is not. You know, one of the inspirations for fascism in Germany in the 20s and Italy was the rise of socialism. It was the Russian Revolution of 1917. Fascism was an ideology committed to smashing socialism, strangling it in its crib, as it were. And the history of the 1920s and the 1930s is that kind of dialectical tension between those two trains of thinking. So we're back in the moment when fascism and socialism are juxtaposed. We think that this moment is different because we actually think lots and lots of people are sympathetic, not just to Tom, but to his ideas. You know, we have a democratic socialist mayor of New York City. I mean, it's really an interesting moment. And to watch Donald Trump say, I'm not going to send any more money to New York City if that communist gets elected, really should be a historical reminder for us that socialism is always on the right side. It's always on the right side, particularly when it comes to fascism. The best fighters against fascism historically have been people like Rosa Luxemburg and Walter Benjamin and Tom Alter now, who are stridently pro-democrat and anti-fascist. So what we take from history as socialists is that we're going to win. It's going to take time. It's going to be a hard fight. But there's no question that Tom feels, and we can see the massive support that he has out there among ordinary people. What we don't have right now is control of the levers of power, but that's also part of the socialist project, is to, you know, wrest those levers away and put them in the hands of working people so that we don't have to deal with this kind of injustice.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about the case of Tom Alter and the course of the fight against fascism in the U.S. What can concerned listeners do to support his case, and both specifically and more broadly?
Thank you for asking that. There's two things I would suggest. We have a website. The campaign has a website, which is defendtomalter.com, and it has a number of resources there for people who would like to support Tom. Right now, we're in the middle of a letter writing and phone call campaign targeting Texas State University and its Board of Regents. Tom has a crucial hearing concerning his appeal for reinstatement. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to the defendtomalter.com. They can make phone calls to the Board of Regents. They can call the president's office. They can write letters demanding that Tom be reinstated. So that's one really important thing. If I can just say one thing about the support. We started that letter writing campaign a week ago. We've had more than 4,000 letters sent to the university, and they are feeling the heat because they recognize that what they've done is that they violated the trust of the international community by firing Tom. The second thing is Tom is off the payroll since he's been terminated. He has a family of four and two children and a house in San Marcos. He has no health insurance because he was terminated from that. We have a GoFundMe campaign for Tom, which is just Tom Alter at GoFundMe, if you Google those words. And we've raised a significant amount of money, $50,000 so far, but it's far from what Tom is going to need, especially if he is not reinstated. So every contribution helps, $5, $10, whatever people can do. It means the world to he and his family to have that support.
We will post those links on our webpage, the website for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Bill
Mole,
for talking with us about the case of Tom Alter.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Freedom of speech. Freedom to say. Freedom to think. This is my lucky day. Freedom of thought. Freedom of dreams. Freedom to believe that we all can be kings.
That was John Mellencamp with his song Freedom of Speech. Before that, you heard Fran Michel and Bill Mullen talking about the campaign to defend fired professor Tom Alter. Multiple links for you to take action in defense of Alter are posted on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Our legal system is currently awash with challenges to the many, many gross violations of our civil rights perpetrated by the Trump administration and his allies. But will these legal actions save us? Public interest attorney Chamtoli Huck provides her answer to this question on Substack, published October 3rd. Here are excerpts from her informed opinion. Donald Trump's recent executive order, or EO, designating Antifa as a domestic terror organization, issued in the wake of conservative commentator Charlie Kirk's murder, is framed as a measure to denounce political violence. Antifa was singled out, even though the person accused of murdering Kirk demonstrated no support for the political ideology. In reality, the Antifa EO is an authoritarian maneuver aimed at criminalizing political speech, protest, and organizing. Authoritarians use various levers of control to shift power from the people to the hands of one ruler or set of rulers. They consolidate their powers incrementally and gradually. This EO should be understood as part of an ongoing move in a broader authoritarian strategy. To label dissent as terrorism and to silence opposition under the guise of public safety. By invoking Antifa, the administration provides a pretext for criminalizing any community-based resistance to aggressive policing, deportation raids, or state violence. Some legal commentators dismiss this order as toothless, arguing that it lacks statutory basis since the U.S. has no legal mechanism for designating domestic groups as terrorist organizations. While technically correct, such analysis misses the point. The purpose of this Antifa EO is not legality, but intimidation. It provides rhetorical and regulatory cover for escalating repression, enabling ICE and federal agencies to justify aggressive enforcement, surveillance, and infiltration of protest movements. The Antifa EO reshapes the narrative by branding those who oppose Trump's policies as anti-American. It promotes the idea that dissent equals terrorism. This narrative is intended to shape the public's view against political organizing. Too often, liberal lawyers place faith in the courts, believing that unconstitutional laws will eventually be overturned. That may indeed occur, but the damage occurs long before a case reaches the judiciary. That Antifa is not a legally constituted organization is precisely why it was chosen. Its ambiguity makes it a useful stand-in for any and all protest movements. The media, often complicit, reinforces this vagueness by portraying Antifa as a, quote, violent protest culture of far-left activists. This framing allows the state to conflate property damage or disruptive protest tactics with terrorism. In effect, any form of civil disobedience can now be cast as terrorism, including sit-ins, direct action against deportation, labor strikes, or even marches that block traffic. This tactic is not new. During the Red Scare and McCarthy era, accusations of communist affiliation justified blacklists, firings, deportations, and imprisonment. The FBI's COINTELPRO program systematically targeted civil rights leaders, black radicals, and anti-war activists. Each of these campaigns relied on fear, vagueness, and media complicity to suppress democratic movements. History demonstrates that community defense has consistently offered the most effective shield against authoritarian repression. Mutual aid networks ensure that when activists lose jobs, face detention, or encounter state harassment, they are not left isolated. Safety planning and rapid response teams enable neighborhoods to mobilize quickly when ICE raids occur, when protesters are targeted, or when police escalate violence. Solidarity infrastructures such as legal support hotlines, bail funds, community kitchens, and sanctuary spaces transform resistance from individual risk into collective strength. Legal victories are necessary, but litigation alone cannot sustain movements under siege. It must be paired with grassroots strategies that keep people safe, nurture resilience, and reaffirm the legitimacy of dissent. Community defense builds power at the local level and signals that repression will not succeed in silencing opposition. In this way, the law becomes one tool among many, rather than the sole battleground in the struggle against authoritarianism. Whereas authoritarianism isolates people through fear and surveillance, community defense collectivizes our struggle and makes us feel we are part of a larger fight for democracy. The lesson from history is clear. Authoritarianism thrives when communities allow the state to define who is dangerous and who is American. The response must be equally clear. Refuse this narrative, defend dissent, and build movements that cannot be silenced. You just heard an edited version of Chaum Tole Huck's article titled Authoritarian Strategy, Criminalizing Dissent and Protest. A link to the full article is posted on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm. We turn now to our Left and Law segment with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, who look at questions of the law and political organizing through the lens of UN efforts to stop the genocide in Gaza.
Donald Trump continues to loudly lobby for himself as worthy of the Nobel Peace Prize based on his 20-point peace plan for Gaza. Point 3 of the plan that went into effect on October 9th includes a ceasefire and, quote, an immediate end to the war, unquote. It also calls for the distribution of aid in Gaza and the Gaza Strip through the United Nations and its agencies and the Red Cross. Well, Mike, we'll be talking today about the International Court of Justice and UN resolutions on Palestine and Israel. But let's start with the ceasefire, which have been enthusiastically proclaimed by Western powers as a success, despite being cast in doubt by facts on the ground.
You're right, Jan. The facts on the ground are that a genocide is continuing. And I use that word advisedly. In 1948, the concept of genocide was defined and accepted by the whole world in the wake of World War II, in the wake of the Holocaust. And by every definition of genocide, the genocide has continued to this very day. People are continuing to be killed every day. The deprivation of food, the cutting off of water, all of these supporting mechanisms of suppressing people that are included in the definition of genocide, like the destruction of housing, is continuing to this very day.
And of course, one effect of this 20-point so-called peace plan is that it's been really proclaimed as a way to repress or marginalize the genocide itself, as though it's all coming to an end. And increasingly, of course, people concerned around the world and in the U.S. with this ongoing genocide are turning to the United Nations and its courts and various mechanisms for addressing the genocide. Give us an update on that.
Okay, well, in December of 2023, South Africa presented the UN with a very meticulous and thorough petition that the actions of Israel be declared a genocide. It defined carefully with the act, it supported with all sorts of factual references exactly how the act has been violated by Israel. The court, the International Court of Justice, which is the UN's General Court, found the allegations of genocide plausible in January of 2024 and issued the first of a series of provisional measures that were supposed to be binding on the Israeli regime. A few months later, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Well, what happened was the court was not only rejected, but its separate judges were demonized by the United States and refused entry to the U.S. In July of 2024, the ICJ issued a landmark advisory opinion concluding that Israel was committing apartheid in all of the West Bank, as well as Gaza and East Jerusalem, that they were unlawfully occupied, then that Israel had to remove all settlements, settlers, soldiers, occupation infrastructure, dismantle the apartheid wall, provide reparations to the Palestinians, and allow all those who have been forced out to return home. Well, Israel has done absolutely nothing to comply with that, and instead we've seen murders of tens of thousands of people, all live streamed, the destruction of housing for 90% of Gaza, where more than 2 million people live, the blocking of any delivery of aid after the destruction of any means of producing one's own food, destruction of cemeteries, universities, hospitals, and of all reporters who reported these actions.
Mike, just to say a little more on that July 2024 ICJ opinion, it also includes calling out other countries that may be complicit in the genocide through their military support of Israel. And the UN has a job partly in calling out the supporters of a genocide. What about that part of the ruling and its fate?
Well, you're totally right. The Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide included all the kinds of supportive actions that have been made by so many other governments, primarily the U.S., and also the UK and Germany. they've explicitly violated provisions of the Convention Against Genocide by how they've supported Israel not only with billions of dollars worth of bombs, which Israel could never have manufactured on their own, but with all the other provisions of support that they've provided in continuing this genocide. So yeah, they are every bit as complicit, and they should be tried according to laws that they have all accepted back when it was only Germany's World War II behavior that was at issue. They've since used only against Pol Pot and Yugoslavia, but have absolutely refused to accept any application of these laws to their own behavior.
There are a number of other bodies within the United Nations that have been pressured to do more in stopping Israel, including the United Nations General Assembly, demands on them to send a protective force to Palestine and to unseat Israel, the Security Council that is controlled by the U.S. So how do you gauge the possibilities for actions through the UN General Assembly or other bodies, given that many Palestinian organizations in Gaza and West Bank are calling for that?
Well, the United Nations General Assembly took the ICJ's landmark advisory opinion, and they concluded that action needed to be directly taken. So the General Assembly found first that the negotiations and agreements between Israel and Palestine were not sufficient. One of the big beefs or points insisted on by the U.S. and Israel is that matters can only be resolved between Israel and Palestine. But that is worse than Goliath and David. I mean, the army, the backing, the hegemony of Israel is so utter and complete that there's no negotiation possible. There are no negotiation requires two parties, which has something that the other wants. And the Israelis essentially want the Palestinians to be gone. And the Palestinians are completely incapable of negotiating any truce that would compel Israel to do anything.
Can you say something about this call for the UN General Assembly to impose sanctions, a military embargo, the rejection of the credentials of the Israeli regime, the establishment of a criminal tribunal, and the reactivation of the UN's anti-apartheid mechanisms, mandating of a UN protection force to protect civilians, ensure humanitarian aid, and so on. Are those calls within the capacity of the General Assembly to respond, or are they more part of pushing the narrative around what's happening?
Yeah, the findings of all the judicial and expert bodies that have found genocide finally broke through to the political bodies of the UN. And on September of 2024, a little over a year ago, the UN General Assembly adopted a pretty dramatic resolution, basically taking the findings of the ICJ that were provisional and then declaring the occupation and apartheid unlawful, demanding an end to the entire occupation and assault on Gaza, setting a one-year deadline for Israeli compliance. And they managed to formulate an agenda for Israeli accountability that developed a plan of adoption at the General Assembly of the UN that would use its extraordinary power to get around the U.S. veto in the Security Council and mandate concrete measures for a change and accountability and protection. That initiative was embraced most recently by Colombian President Gustavo Petro, who in his speech before the 80th session of the UN General Assembly just last month promised to introduce this proposal as a draft resolution. But it's being countered by a couple of other provisions, what's called the French-Saudi track, where they are French and Saudi Arabia are devising a plan that's essentially like the Trump plan that you began with. It doesn't do anything to empower the Palestinians at all. It would lessen the body count, but it would not in any way rearrange the power relationship that exists at present. So that's where we're at with the UN. The ICC has not formally made its complete findings, but the UN General Assembly has ran with what the court found and basically found Israel to be in contempt of the Genocide Convention and have done all that they possibly can or are working toward having the UN itself condemn Israel and even remove its credentials.
That seems more within the province of what could be done politically within the constraints of the United Nations, which does not have a standing army or troops. And so it's difficult to respond to calls to send protective forces into Gaza. Are some of these other sanctions more within their powers? And what would be involved in unseating Israel? And are there other precedents for that that come to mind?
To my knowledge, there are not. But provisions set out in this, we could call it the justice track. There are these three tracks we've mentioned. The Trump track, which you began with, the French and Saudi slight variation, and then the we call the justice track. The likelihood of the justice track being enacted, I think, now that it's been specifically articulated, it's got some legs. It, of course, doesn't have the power and the muscle. But I think it's going to be finally a matter of credibility. And people all over the world are reacting in extraordinary ways. I mean, in the Netherlands, there were 250,000 people on the streets of Amsterdam protesting against the genocide. In Italy, several Italian towns have been flooded with the biggest demonstrations they've ever felt against what's happening in Gaza. Huge demonstrations in this country. There's a sentiment of the world is really swinging hard. And I think Israel's isolation continues to increase. And it's a volatile situation. But I think one of the best ways to resolve it would be precisely to follow the track of the UN General Assembly. That would require Israel to change its behavior. It, of course, the UN, as you said, has no army of its own capable of enforcing such a prospect. But Israel has got to make those moves, positive moves, I think, or it will just flame out.
Yeah, I think what we saw in the victory last week of Zoran Mamdani, who's now the mayor-elect of New York City, is itself an expression of these political struggles going on around the world with all of the powerful and the forces of their military-industrial complex arrayed against everyday people and social movements that are organizing. And I think having some success with this recent election and the protests that continue in this country as well against Israel and in support of the global justice movement. Do you want to say anything in closing about the success of the, it's not just Mamdani, but the broad social movement of activists and everyday people behind that campaign that, of course, are vital to any success it might have, given that it's going to come up against these forces that attempt to crush it?
Mamdani is incredibly important. He has consistently opposed Israel as a nation that is an ethno-nationalist nation. He supports everybody who lives in Israel. He believes it should be a secular place and that all the Muslims as well as the Jews should be able to vote in Israel. It's phenomenal that he would not only be able to articulate this provision, and this is a man who went to bar and bat mitzvahs throughout his childhood. He grew up with Jews in New York City. He knows all sorts of Jews and was supported by hundreds of thousands of them in the election. because he's opposed to the genocide that's being perpetrated right now. And his election marks the success of that view, the fact that it's no longer toxic to have question Israel's activities in any way. I mean, if a guy can win in New York City with a view of Israel that would prefer Israel to be a secular place, is stunning. It's just unheard of, and it's going to reverberate, I think, in this country where people have been crushed on college campuses for opposing Israel. The conflation of Israel with Jews, which did not exist until a year or two ago, has been, I think, will ultimately be a disaster unless it's aborted right now, because as you and I know, in the fields we've worked in over our lives, are just clogged with Jews. They're everywhere. I've hired Jews. I've been hired by Jews. But I've never thought that they were related to Israel. Some had some relationships with Israel. Others had nothing to do with Israel. But any more than I would think that people from Brazil were, should be identified with the Brazilian military dictatorship that prevailed in Brazil for 17 years. The idea that Israel is synonymous with Jews is a bad idea. It's not a true idea. It's one wished for by an Israeli regime that is corrupt and unbelievably violent, is essentially a group of murderous thugs and who should be opposed, I think, in every way. And now it's legitimate to do so.
Yeah, and the narrative has not only argued that Jews have an inherent identification and interest in the survival of Israel as an ethno-nationalist project, but also that their own safety in their own countries depends on the survival of Israel, which is a very manipulative use of the legacy of the Holocaust that has for a long time also terrorized young people into thinking that they could only be safe in Israel, that somehow their safety depends on that, which is a kind of bargain people make around hell. You obey us, children, or you're going to go to hell. So it has become hell there, and we can see what an illusion that is, not only for this history of phony peace plans, and the exposure of what Israel is really about, but also exposing the lie of Jewish interests in sustaining that genocide and that project.
That's right.
Okay, well, Mike, we'll continue to follow this, and I think there will be a time when there'll be a call for some kind of transitional justice or Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there will be some reckoning here on earth for what's happening there. And so we can work to not only pressure whatever ways we can and mobilize to end the genocide and the occupation and the apartheid, but also thinking about the role of the United Nations in transitional justice and the accountability that has been part of that legacy of resolutions around genocide.
And I do hope the UN's General Assembly's plan is the one that carries the day. It would not only be a just plan, but it would reinforce the presence of the United Nations in the world's life, which I think was a really important thing to happen.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. So we will continue.
The music you just heard is by the Palestinian band Carlo, with their piece, Jude. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker were talking about the UN and genocide. That's it for our show today. Thanks to Fran Michel, Mike Snedeker, and Jan Hocken for their segments, and a special thanks to Bill Mullen, our guest. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Until then, stay safe, and above all, stay active. I'm going to go out with the classic protest song by Stevie Wonder. You haven't done nothing.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, my name is Jeff, and I host a show entitled A Matter of Public Records that is broadcast on